Now, if you're going to do medication, you shouldn't just do medication by itself. It should be medication with the self, the parent, the classroom, and the, you know, all that stuff. Because again, it's about skill building. The medication doesn't give them the skills. The medication helps the brain regulate, right? The skills helps the skills. And so if you're going to help, you need to be able to teach them a variety of skills to learn flexibility and attention and organization and planning and problem solving. That's where the teaching comes in. And that's how you can help them with the medication, helping them regulate themselves.
And if you want to be a part of the conversation too, then subscribe to my Patreon, www.patreon.com/Mr. Chaz, and join the conversation. Ask your own questions. Be a part of it for as low as $5 a month and get access to one-on-one coaching with me for as low as $20 a month.
What's my name? What's my name? What's my name?
Welcome to Mr. Chaz's Leadership, Parenting, and Teaching podcast, where I introduce you to the people who can help you on your parenting, leadership, or teaching journey. And today I have Dr. Ann Louise Lockhart back at it for another conversation. And today we're talking about ADHD, and I'm going to have her reintroduce herself, and then we will get started right with the conversation.
All right. Thanks, Chaz. So I'm Dr. Ann Louise Lockhart. I'm a pediatric psychologist, parent coach. I'm also an author and a speaker, and I'm a mom of two as well, and a business owner. So I have lots of different hats and things that I do. And I'm really passionate about teaching parents and teachers about child development and helping them maneuver things that feel hard in that journey. So, yeah.
Well, this will be part of that journey of helping, you know, teachers and parents really understand children and navigate and help them and work with them by understanding child development. So let me just go ahead and ask the most general question I can ask on the topic. What is ADHD? I'll stop there. What is ADHD?
What is ADHD? Okay. So ADHD is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And it is an executive functioning dysregulation disorder. So it's a neurodevelopmental disorder, which means it's brain based. And it's primarily believed to be housed in the prefrontal cortex, which is in the frontal lobe region of the brain, which is the last part of the brain to develop. And it's thought to be an underactive frontal lobe and or a sleepy brain. So it's not engaging and firing like it's supposed to with compared to neurotypical kids. So that's kind of the general definition. It's just an executive functioning dysregulation disorder. So it's the inability to regulate attention, thoughts, behaviors, and mood. So it's just dysregulation. And I think that's where people are like, well, sometimes they may hyper-focused and sometimes they may be totally inattentive. So it's the range of attention, depending on how interesting or engaging the activity is.
So you mentioned, okay, so it sounds like you were also talking about ADHD and ADD. Can you talk a little bit more about what the difference is and how you can identify the difference? Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes. So ADD doesn't exist anymore as a diagnosis. They got rid of that diagnosis. And did you want me to stop, Jess, or are we good?
No, I'm listening. Keep going. Okay. I'm just taking my charger.
So,
keep going.
So ADD as a diagnosis is no longer, they got rid of it. I think it was 1980 or 1985. It was in the few editions of the diagnostic manual, previous editions. And ADD was attention deficit disorder. And that was part of the inattention. That was the inattention kind of housed under that diagnosis. They got rid of that as an official diagnosis. And now ADHD has three types. There's ADHD inattentive type, ADHD hyperactive impulsive type, and ADHD combined type. So the ADHD inattentive type is what was previously known as ADD. Mm-hmm. So when people say, oh, I have ADD or my kid has ADD, what they're talking about is the ADHD primarily inattentive type, because ADD as a diagnosis no longer exists.
Hmm.
It's like 30 years not existing.
So talk to us a little bit more about what's happening in the brain. You did mention that the prefrontal cortex, it's not engaging like
right.
What a typical brain would. Talk to me a little bit more about that and maybe even talk about kind of what it looks like in real life. Tell us what happens in the brain and what does that mm-hmm. look like in a, you know, in a home setting, in a school setting, and how does that show up?
So it is what people often look at it as an understimulated prefrontal cortex. And so it's that it's not picking up the message the brain is trying to communicate by communicating to the other lobes. So it's like the brain is trying to tell you, for example, stop fidgeting and pay attention to the teacher. She's talking to you. And then they're like, huh, what, huh? And so it's the slow on the uptake. So processing speed, for example, is an executive functioning skill, which is often impacted actually significantly by ADHD. And processing speed is how I compare it to like when you're going to watch Netflix and you have the little circle that's buffering and buffering and buffering. That's processing speed. It's that Netflix knows which movie and show you selected, but then you're waiting.
Yeah.
Right? So yeah. The child got your message. And then as they're staring at you and staring into space and you're like waiting for them to engage, that's processing speed. And that's most impacted. That's one of the executive functioning skills that's most impacted by ADHD. So that's a huge one. The working memory is another one. And that's your ability to take in information and then act on it in a few seconds at a time. So being able to say, hey, go ahead and clean up for dinner and then go ahead and put away your shoes and then come back. And so then having to remember the steps, hold on to them, and then act on them without getting distracted and sidetracked is another huge weakness for a lot of individuals with ADHD. But there is like, I don't know, 15, 20 executive function skills that can be impacted. It could be flexibility, attention, time management, self-monitoring, task initiation and persistence, motivation, let me think, flexibility, said adaptability. I'm trying to think, what were the others? But there's a lot of different ones that are totally impacted because what's happening is that you are trying to figure out, what do I do with this information? How do I engage in it? Emotional regulation is another one. Making decisions, problem solving, judgment, self-control, organization, response inhibition, so holding back, and your personality. That's a lot of stuff. And that's all frontal lobe, right? That's all frontal lobe. And that's not finished growing until age 25, 26. And so every kid has an underdeveloped frontal lobe until about age 25. But then when you throw in ADHD on top of that, now they have an underdeveloped frontal lobe and an underactive frontal lobe. So when you want them to make a good choice, you want them to stop having that tantrum, you want them to start their homework, all of those things are all executive functioning. And if you have ADHD and you're a kid, you have this double whammy against you because your brain is not engaging like it should for a neurotypical kid.
And so mm-hmm. you mentioned a lot of skills there.
That's a lot of skills.
and you know, it makes me think, so how do we actually, are those things, like what can we do to help them, you know, to help ADHD kids with, you know, organization? Like, is it something that will forever be a challenge for them? Is there something that we can do early on? Is about, you know, learning, teaching the child tools to navigate through kind of their own, you know, their own specific challenges? Mm-hmm. How do we help ADHD kids in the short term and the long term?
Yes, great question. So executive functioning skills are skills that can be learned. So just like any other skill, you can learn to manage your time. You can learn to get organized. You can learn to have a better memory. You can learn to exercise better judgment. You can learn better impulse control. You can learn to inhibit your responses and not speak out of turn. You can learn to be to initiate and manage your time. Like, those are all things you can learn. The thing is that it just requires a lot more conscious and deliberate effort. But it has to be repeated over time. So a big thing with the kids with ADHD is that their working memory and their short-term memory is really terrible. They don't remember very well. They can be very, very forgetful, which is why they don't know how to track a conversation well, which is why they sometimes are really bad at math, because you need really good working memory for math, because you have to hold the numbers in your brain, right? And process it and manipulate it, do mental math.
Yeah.
That's why reading is often a challenge for them, because reading requires a lot of working memory and processing speed. Even word problems is that you have to be able to read something and then say, wait, what did they just say? What did I just read at the top of the page? So a lot of kids with ADHD, they like reread and they're like, they don't get it. Or they're watching a show and then you ask them, hey, what's this about? I don't know. Dude, like, haven't you been watching? Because yeah. They're like having a hard time tracking and remembering who the character was, what they said, what's that person's name, what's the plot, what if I have 4 apples and you got 2 apples and we were traveling at 60 miles an hour? Like, they don't hold on to all this information and remember it, and then they can get easily sidetracked. And so all of that stuff is really skill building and teaching them. That's why I really believe strongly, if your kid has ADHD, is educating them about the diagnosis so that they understand what it means, where in the brain it is, showing them a picture of the brain and what that part of the brain is responsible for all the executive functioning skills. And then you tell them that although these may be areas of weakness, which we know through like testing, for example, these are the areas that you're great at, these are the areas where you struggle in. And so then we can build those skills. And ideally, you do it through teaching them the skills so that they can do it themselves. It's through effective parenting strategies so that you're parenting a kid with ADHD and not just a kid that doesn't have one. Because if you parent a child who's not ADHD and one who is ADHD, you have to parent them differently, because the reminders, the getting off track, all of that stuff is a huge challenge for them. And so it's about the self-management strategies, effective parenting strategies, and then effective classroom strategies. Because again, as a teacher, there's going to be things that you're going to do in terms of accommodations that are going to feel like you're babying them or handholding them or doing things that are unfair compared to the other kids. But kids with ADHD have a right to have reasonable accommodations. Actually, it's a legal right to have reasonable accommodations through the Americans with Disabilities Act. And so if it requires like untimed tests, decreased homework load, reading the test to them, doing a test in an individual setting versus a group setting, having noise canceling headphones, like being able to have a standing desk, like any reasonable accommodation is what can help them. And so these things is about putting in accommodations, but then also teaching them the skill so that they can learn it. So teaching them, for example, organization, because many times kids with ADHD are really disorganized. So it's about teaching them, okay, in order to organize yourself, rather than cleaning your whole room at once, start with your desk and work on your desk for 30 minutes. And then it's about then also then helping them. Okay, then once you're done with that, then move to the closet. And then when you're done with that, move to your bookshelf. And you organize that through putting all the books away or putting all the clothes away. It's whatever you're doing, you're just walking them step by step by step. So yes, you can learn and they can teach executive function skills. It's just that it takes a lot of deliberate effort and it can be really painful because their brain isn't naturally wired that way. So it takes a lot of repetition. But the good news is that they have really great long-term memory, and the long-term memory happens from repetition. And so they don't have to always suffer with it. They just have to keep repeating it and repeating it. And I always tell kids and teenagers that I see is that you get better at the thing you practice. So the more you practice healthy habits and good skills, you will get better at it.
Yeah. Man, I'm listening to you talk, and I haven't even shared this in the whole podcast, but I was diagnosed with ADHD in seventh grade. Mm-hmm. And I'm hearing you talk, and I'm just like, yeah, that was, yep, that was me. That was me. Yep, I struggled with that. Yep, I had to learn that. Yep. And even, you know, something that I recognized about myself, and I didn't necessarily have the words to put it in to until later in life, but I always knew that anytime I do something, I start something, the first time, like let's say it's a group of people, like we're going to, we just first get a game or we're learning a concept or whatever it is, at first I'm always like one of like the worst ones at it. Like anytime I'm starting a new skill, I feel like I'm below average. But through like time and practice, I feel like when I practice, when I actually put my all into something, that I become above average than the same person who picked up the game, you know, at the same time. We both bought the game at the same time. But, you know, maybe I practice a little bit more. I don't know. But it's something that I've seen pretty consistently in my life. And so for me, you know, how does that inform kind of my decision, my life decisions when, and you also talked about persistence as well and all these, you know, all these other things that I struggle with. It became, I understood about myself that I had to do something that I really enjoyed doing, that I couldn't like pick a career or a job to just suffer through. And because I knew that wouldn't be something that I would be able to become great at, or something that I would even, I also knew like my mental health would greatly suffer for, you know, putting myself through that. Like I know what school felt like having to do that, you know, every day, and especially certain classes that I would dread going to because of maybe the teaching style. And so that's something like I knew about myself. And maybe I think when I finally made the decision, I maybe had a better understanding about ADHD. But as I was moving towards that direction, I didn't have the words to put it in. I didn't connect that necessarily with my diagnosis of being ADHD. I just knew that about myself. And so, you know, go ahead.
Wait, let me say something about that too. Cause I think we talk a lot about ADHD as having all these symptoms and deficits. And I like to look at it from a strengths-based approach. Like ADHD, there's a lot of great things about it when you have it. Okay.
Yeah.
Because people, when I meet someone with ADHD and they're in the workplace or in the business setting or whatever, they have tons of energy. They're extremely creative. They're highly engaging individuals. They're out of the box thinkers. They are the life of the party. They know how to get stuff started. And so even if they may struggle with something, a big part of it is that they persist. And when they persist, like you said, because of that repetition, they can excel at it and get super, super good at it. Mm. And so I think we also have to look at it from a strengths-based approach, is that these are things that, although there's some sucky things about it that may not be great for you, there's some amazing things about it that you also have to be aware of. And so with the hyperactivity impulsive type, people will tend to kind of mellow out as they get older and as their brain gets more mature. And so instead of like jumping on the couch and, you know, being extra busy, you may just be more of that restless person, or that you just are antsy and always have to be on the go. And so it's kind of more refined because you become this mature adult. But for the inattentive type, that one tends to persist, and adults tend not to outgrow that one. That's the harder one to outgrow, because you still kind of feel like you're in your own world. And these are the people who are procrastinators, who are forgetful about things they have to remember. So they forget like their backpack, even though they're going to school, or, you know, like things that they need. And so these are the people that kind of go off and they're not able to focus on things. And sometimes that's where it infects relationships at work, your job, your romantic relationships, your parenting relationships, because you're not holding on to and remembering things that you should, because your memory is not that great sometimes. So those are things I think it's important to look at it from a symptom perspective, but also from a strengths-based perspective as well too.
Yeah. And that's great, because that was literally what I was about to ask you. Like, what are what are the positive things? Are there positive things about
There's
it?
There's totally a lot of positives. Yeah. Because, you know, my kids had a principal who had ADHD and a learning disability, and she was the best principal because she had so much energy. She went to all the kids' games. She was always engaged with the fun stuff on the field day. Like, she was all up in the stuff because she had nonstop energy, and she could relate to the kids when they made poor decisions. And so I think when people have ADHD, it really makes them so relatable to kids who are struggling, because they get it. They get it. That's why you are so good at what you do, because you get it.
Yeah. No, I feel like that is spot on. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, it seems like a lot of times the place where it shows up, where people really like, we need to, get this, there's something not right here, is like the thought process or the message that is given. But it typically, at least what I notice and in my life, was more of a problem at school.
Yeah.
And it makes me wonder, seeing like this, it's really a difference. There's strengths and there's weaknesses, just like neurotypical people have, right? And I wonder, something I'm always thinking about, because I don't think that there's necessarily just one right answer. And I think I talk a lot about, like, we need to change, the education system. Right now it seems like it's built for neurotypical people, but we know that there are such a range of brains that are entering the school system. And I wonder how we could, if we were to make a change to the school system that would be helpful for everyone, neurotypical and neurodiverse people, children, what would that be for you? What would that look like for you? Is there, something like strategies or ways of teaching that you think that would reach kind of everyone, or how would you approach that? Yep. Talk a little bit about that.
So I do a lot of presentations to schools and school districts. And one of the things that I emphasize a ton is that one of the best ways you can then teach to everyone, regardless, if they have autism, Tourette's, ADHD, depression, anxiety, behavioral issues, or they're just the perfect student, is that you teach executive function and skills. And that should be the first thing you teach at the beginning of the school year, and then weave it throughout all of your lessons. That means that the first, actually, 2 to 3 weeks should be dedicated to teaching kids how to manage themselves. Because if you know how to be flexible when things change, you know how to be adaptable when things don't go your way, you know how to have emotional regulation and impulse control, and how to speak your mind, and how to bring it back, and how to all these things, then when you don't get that math lesson, when someone is mean to you on the playground, when the teacher says something that you took offense to, rather than you freaking out and melting down and running away from the problem or lashing out, you now have executive function skills to help you manage those things. You're going to see less behavioral issues. You'll see less hatred of school and certain subjects. You'll see more better social interactions and relationships between peers and students and teachers. I mean, it's huge. It's huge. And so I think teaching those executive function skills and integrating it into your lesson, and not focusing so much on standardized testing and, always getting to the academics. Yes, those are important, but they are not more important than social and emotional intelligence. Mm. And so I think that is the best way to do that, is that you integrate that in your lesson initially, and then you weave it in your lessons, emotional intelligence, impulse control, social stories, social groups, and having other kids talk about that. Because 1 in 5 children has a mental health disorder. 20% of kids in the U.S. has a mental health disorder, the majority of it being ADHD. So you're talking about one in five kids in every classroom who has a mental health disorder, and we're not teaching these things. Mm-hmm. So then when kids are dealing with depression or trauma or anxiety, and again, ADHD isn't by itself. Lots of people with ADHD have ADHD plus depression, ADHD plus anxiety, ADHD plus autism, ADHD plus a math disability. So then we have that combined with maybe home drama, trauma that they've experienced, a divorce, a move, a deployment, an injury, a sickness. And then we're expecting they should just know how to read and do math and learn and do these tests. And I think we're missing out a lot of stuff on that because kids are not just focused on that one thing. They are, whenever I look at parent coaching or therapy, I do it from a systemic perspective. Like, we are part of a system. We are holistic. So we have to deal with it from all perspectives. Because if we don't, that's why kids hate school, why we're missing them. They're falling through the cracks. And we're having all these behavioral issues and kids lashing out because they don't have the skills to be able to handle those things.
Yeah. So how do you, you know, let's say you are a parent and you think that your child has ADHD, or maybe you've gotten a diagnosis, like, how do you advocate for your child and make sure that they get what they need in the school system?
Yes. So I think if you suspect your child has ADHD, and you can actually get a full assessment as early as 4, I usually like to wait at least until their school age, about age 5, but you can still do it by age 4. And what that would mean is that you would see a child psychologist or neuropsychologist who can do a full assessment. A lot of people go to their pediatricians to get a diagnosis, and I would recommend that that's just a screening. A full assessment should come from someone who will do a full diagnostic. So that would be a neuropsychologist or a child psychologist, and they would do standardized testing and academic testing. So anything that's based on IQ, based on their achievement level. And it would also rule out what else it could be, because ADHD looks like a lot of stuff. And so that person should also look at, okay, could it be anxiety? Could it also be depression? Could it be trauma? Could it be a learning disability? So they're looking at all the other things that it could be so that they can rule it out and then rule it in. So I see ADHD as a rule out diagnosis because it looks like a lot of stuff. A lot of stuff resembles it. So once you have that full testing, that's how you advocate for your kid. So get a full testing, and it needs to be the symptoms. In order to have a diagnosis of ADHD, the symptoms have to be present in at least 2 settings. And then it has to cause functional impairment in those settings. So like school and home. And the impairment may not be academics, because you may have a straight A student who has ADHD, but maybe the impairment is social skills. Maybe it's behavioral stuff. Maybe they can never turn in their homework on time. Like, what is the actual impairment? Because then they may need further interventions. And so that's where, you know, looking at that and then saying, okay, if once you have a diagnosis, you have a report that says this is their diagnosis, then the school is required to provide reasonable accommodations based on the Americans with Disabilities Act. ADHD is a covered diagnosis. Just like if your kid had cancer, or were in a wheelchair, or they were blind, or they were on crutches, or anything, sickle cell, any of those kinds of things are covered. And so because ADHD is considered an other health impairment, then they're able to receive reasonable accommodation. So then you can ask, okay, what would be those accommodations that they would need? And that report should tell you. Maybe they need to have on-time tests, reduced homework load, a test read to them. Maybe they need to be in a smaller classroom. Modified problems. So instead of getting the full 20 math problems, they do only the odd problems. So things like that. It could be very creative, reasonable accommodations, and they have a right to receive them. Schools can get in trouble for not providing those accommodations. Yeah. It's a legal right.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one thing that really stuck out to me that you said is that it has to cause disruption in 2 different settings. Mm-hmm. And I think about how do we know it's not the setting that is more of the issue than the child and their brain?
That's a great question. I mean, we don't, right? And so that's why one of the things that I like to do is a functional behavior analysis with teachers and parents is to really look at, okay, what is the time of day when this behavioral disruption or problematic stuff is happening? Who is present? What is the antecedent? So what is the thing that is told? So, okay, get ready to pack up or get in line or time to go to school. Like, what is the thing that comes before the behavior? Looking at the behavior itself in detail, the consequence. So then how does that person respond to the behavior when it occurs? And then why do you think this occurs? So then that's when you're thinking of like this hypothesis, and we're serving as detectives to find out, okay, what are the factors that are leading to this? So that way you can say, okay, well, when we remove the antecedent or when we remove the consequence or when we change the time of day. So if every time we go from lunch to math class, the student falls out and they're always ended up in the principal's office or the nurse's office, or they're always complaining that their stomach hurts and they're whining. Okay. So what could be the reason? Maybe it's math class. Maybe they didn't get enough to eat. Maybe they ate the wrong stuff. Maybe they don't like the standing in line. Maybe there's a kid in their class that they don't like. Maybe they don't like the teacher.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah. We have to tease out all the possible reasons. And then we slowly tease them out. Say, well, what if we just ask the kid, like, what's the deal? Like, what's going on that this is so difficult for you? Or monitoring, what are they eating for lunch? Monitoring how they're interacting with the other kids in line, how they feel about math.
Yeah.
And then changing up small little things to see, okay, if we have math before lunch, is it any different? If we have a big brother or buddy walking them to math, is it any different? If we change up their lunch menu, is it any different? Like, we're looking, and that's the tedious part, but that's what we can look to see, okay, is it environmental? Is it situational? Is it the child? Yeah. Like, what's going on here?
Yeah.
So that we can, again, it's the systemic perspective. We're looking at it. It's not just the kid that's the problem. We're also looking at the environment and everything else in their environment.
Love it. Awesome. Now I have to ask you, what are your thoughts on medication and medicating ADHD children and how, yeah, just tell me what your thoughts are and what the utility of it is and what the medication actually does to the brain. Talk to us.
Okay. So I think as part of breaking the mental health stigma, I think we also have to break the mental health medication stigma. Okay. So I worked in a military hospital for 10 years, did my training there. And one of the things that I did a lot is working with a lot of interdisciplinary teams. So when a kid came in and they had cancer, we did the least invasive thing first. If they needed treatment, then they did radiation, chemo, the full dose, the whole kind of shebang. If they have sickle cell, we try to do the exercises, the hydration, looking at all these things. They may need a transfusion, a bone marrow transplant. But we're looking at a range of things, medication being one of them, okay? So that's medical stuff. We won't tell a kid with cancer, oh, just walk it off, suck it up. That's ridiculous, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if a kid has ADHD, it's causing impairment. They can't make friends. They're not succeeding well in school. It's causing problems at home. They feel like their self-esteem is tanking. They're not successful. And we're doing the self-management. We're educating them. We're modifying our parenting strategies to be more effective. The teacher is on board with the classroom management strategies. We're doing all these different things. If the ADHD is severe enough that it's causing such impairment to do all of these things, they might benefit from medication. Now, the way medication works is it's a psychostimulant. So a stimulant, now remember, as I said earlier, it's an underactive and understimulated brain. So the stimulant wakes up the brain. And this is where people get kind of confused, because it was confusing for me as well too. Why in the world would you give a hyper kid a stimulant? That don't make no sense, right?
Yeah.
Because their brain is understimulated. So it's not getting the message, dude, shut up. People know you're oversharing. Slow down. Focus. Their brain isn't getting the message. So the stimulant wakes up the brain so they can get the message. So that when the mailman comes to drop off, hey, stop oversharing. hey, slow down, hey, focus. Now they're mentally stimulated enough to say, oh, there's the male. Okay, got it. Let me be quiet now. Yeah. I'm asking too many questions in class. So the psychostimulant, so Focalin, Adderall, Concerta, Ritalin, what all of those do is that it wakes up the sleepy brain so they can get the message, they can process and remember and attend and do all those things more efficiently. And then you can then help them regulate their brain. So it helps with a lot of regulation, and that's why it's so effective.
Yeah.
The problem with stimulants, which I don't know why they can't figure it out quite yet, is that almost all of the stimulants, the one side effect they cannot get a hold of is the appetite suppression. Almost all stimulants come with, kids lose their appetite and then they lose weight. And so that's the one big issue with it. And so when it's done right and it's on the right dose, it can really help them slow themselves down and focus. If they're over-medicated, they're like zombies and their personality shifts. And kids can feel it and they don't like it, which is why they're not as compliant with the medication. Because they feel like, oh, it changed me, or I don't feel like myself. And that's when that's too much medication.
Yeah.
And so that's where we have to realize that. And the stimulant, the cool thing about stimulants is that they work quick. So you put them, you give it to your kid, and within 30 minutes, you feel it. Yeah. And they sense it. And then, but it's the same thing when it leaves the system too.
Yeah.
You come home and now it's out of their system. And now you have this kid that was great all day. And now they're just this wreck at home because now it's off they're off their meds. And that's why for some kids, they do like an extended release, which is the XR.
Yeah.
And so that way it's kind of in the system longer so they could have it all day throughout school and then have it for the homework period.
Yeah. 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 And so my next question is, during school, really to get through the school period, the homework period, medication can be very beneficial. Make sure that you have the right dose for the right child so that it's not, they don't feel like it is changing them and changing their personality. They don't feel like themselves. Long-term, is it your view that people, or maybe even in your experience, that people need to take the medication forever? Is there a certain point like where, you hit 25, 26 and then you're no longer like, okay, I feel like my brain is stimulated enough, developed enough to where I can get by? What's your experience, recommendation? Talk a little bit about that.
It's such a mixed bag. So that's why I really believe that, if you're going to do medication, you shouldn't just do medication by itself. It should be medication with the self, the parent, the classroom, and all that stuff. Because again, it's about skill building. The medication doesn't give them the skills. The medication helps the brain regulate, right? The skills helps the skills. And so if you're going to help, you need to be able to teach them a variety of skills to learn flexibility and attention and organization and planning and problem solving. That's where the teaching comes in. And that's how you can help them with the medication, helping them regulate themselves. So ideally, if they're on the medication, if they need it, and they're doing all these skills and they're being coached and taught and you have everybody on board, then they should get to a point where maybe they need less of the medication or they only need it kind of as needed. And so there's quite a few college students that I work with who have ADHD and they only take it at certain times when they feel like maybe they're overstressed, because stress will mess with your executive functioning. Yeah. The pandemic will mess with your executive functioning. Yeah. Being going through transitions will mess with that. So lots of people have approached me because they're like, I think I have pandemic ADHD, but that's not ADHD. That might just be executive functioning. Like lots of people who are tired and overworked and stressed, that impacts executive functioning. If you have trauma, if you have anxiety, if you have depression, all of that affects executive functioning. So once you can learn those skills and you can teach those skills to your kid, then they may need it less. And then there's other people who say, nope, I do good with just taking my medicine every day. So it's really an individual decision based on how much you need, and really, honestly, based on your job, your occupation, what you do, and what you need to function. Because some people, they're in jobs, ideally, that are based in what they value and that allow them the ability to be who they are without needing to manage it medically too much. So maybe they're the motivational speaker, right? And they need that energy. They don't want to be chilled and subdued because that energy is what they need. Or, you know, maybe, you know, they're the fast. I remember there was a skit, I think it was on Mad TV with the UPS truck driver, and he was always like moving real fast. You know, and so someone who's like engaged and has a job that they, that energy and that creativity is needed, and they may not need the medication for it. And so then they feel like they function just well, they're just fine. So I think it's really an individual decision based on, okay, is, am I having impairment, and does the medication help me to kind of reel it back in so that I can use all my skills as well? So it's really hard to say in terms of how much people need it and if whether or not they need it after they pass mid-20s.
Yeah. And let's talk a little bit more about the skill building. You know, what are some things that, and maybe you can give us, maybe for a variety of ages, from young to old, to young, adolescent, adult, like tell us, talk to us about, you know, what things we can do to build that executive functioning, to build those skills from as young as age 3 or 4 to as old as you and I.
Yes. Okay. So let me, I have some notes on here so I can look at too. So let's see. So if we have, say you want to deal and address the skill of attention. And attention is being able to focus and then be able to shift when you need to. Okay. There's different kinds of attention, but it's about being able to focus and then shift. And so what I would say is for like little itty bitties, like the toddler age is, although like a lot of our classrooms can be very engaging and colorful and lots of stuff going on, is maybe limiting how much busyness is going on in the front of the classroom and leaving it to the sides or the back, for example. So that way they're not so visually overstimulated. For the school age kids, same thing, is that, you know, all the things that we have,
You okay? Is
that a fly? It's a big old spider. I'm good. So, you know, being able to have stuff in the front of the classroom to a minimal, and the stuff on the sides and the back is more of where they can focus on. So they could like turn and then like get to the stuff there. For the high schoolers, so say they're like on a screen or on something like that they're working on, is minimizing the tabs. All the tabs that they have open is having just one browser, turning off the notifications and not having anything else there. Same thing with adults. So if you have ADHD and you are easily distracted, turn off the notifications, close all the extra tabs.
I'm looking at my tabs right now and I have 15. Like I can't even see like the first letter. I just see the icon. My goodness.
Right. Okay. But the thing is that the tabs are okay as long as you're not like constantly then clicking on it while you're trying to do that thing. So that can be really helpful in terms of saying, okay, if I know that I'm going to be distracted and say, oh, snap, I need to do that, click on that tab. Now, what was I doing? Then you need to then have it where you can minimize it. And I know there's a thing, I've been meaning to check this out on Canva, where you can create folders. And then all those tabs you would normally use, you can drag them to different folders. So that way, rather than them being at the top, then they're just in the folders that you could put on your desktop. And so it's like things like that. So that can bring in the attention, bring in the organization piece of the skill. And those can be all things that you kind of integrate. So that would be something that I would say for that. Let's see. For flexibility. That's a good one. So flexibility is a lot of kids with ADHD, flexibility tends to be a big problem. And that's about being able to adapt and then pivot when situations change and being able to shift your attention, your emotions, your thoughts. So when things don't work out as planned, you can say, oh, well, that sucks, but then let's do something else. So what I would say is teaching them how to get unstuck and then finding ways to reboot. So, and then planning for moments of flexibility. So say you have like a preschool class and they were planning on going outside for a walk, but it's pouring rain and now you can't do that. Then you can say, oh, we were so looking forward to our walk today, but what kind of day is it? It's pouring rain. So when it's pouring rain, can we go outside for a walk? No. How do we feel when that happens? Disappointed, right? So what can we do instead? And so then helping them problem solve about things you can do when you feel, when things don't work out as planned. And then for like older kids, what I would say is plan for moments to practice that before it happens. So saying things like, hey, I know that we wanted to get like a burger and watch this particular movie later on today. How about we get like pizza and watch this other movie instead? So still a preferred food, still a preferred movie, but just shifting slightly, just slightly. So that way, what you're doing is you're helping them learn to slowly just adapt to things. And then as they do that, then integrating other things. So like I used to do this with my kids a lot, where I would say, like on the way to do something desirable, I would say, hey, I gotta stop by the bank real quick. Oh, the bank is boring. I know, right? And I do it anyway. So interrupting the flow of what we were planning in our mind so that they get, they don't get stuck on just doing things a certain way. So that when disappointment happens, they don't fall apart.
And maybe when you do that or you're doing it like the first time, like they do fall apart and that's to be expected, right? And that's
right.
A part of the process, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And so let me ask, I have one more question that I want to ask you. So we talked about the skills that we, you know, that we can teach. I want to know one last note. I know screen time comes up a lot, and how can does screen time affect ADHD children differently? I know you talked about flexibility, the ability to stop doing the screen time and to do something else, or for screen time to be when it's over. You know, is do ADHD kids have tend to have bigger reactions in your experience? You know, talk to me a little bit about that, how to even maybe even navigate ADHD in screen time.
Yes, absolutely. So screen time, screens are one of those things that's like a blessing and a curse because it is meant to be stimulating and addicting. That's why it was created. Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Snapchat, computers, games, online games, iPads, like all of that is meant to keep your attention. It wouldn't be doing its job if you were like on it and you like got bored in a few minutes. Like it's meant to draw you in. And so between the blue light in it, which is activating and stimulating for the brain, which creates more serotonin, which makes you happy and gives you more energy. Okay. And then on top of that, the flashing lights, the different levels, the newness of something always happening, like that is an ADHD dream. And that is why kids with ADHD love video games, because there's always a different level. They love novelty. They love stimulation. They love things that are unpredictable, that are new, that are always something that's unfolding, which is often everything school is not. Boring, predictable, same, same, every day. Right. And so a lot of the screens gives them that boost of dopamine and it's like a drug for them. And so it is very stimulating, which is why they don't want to get off of it. So what I would say is that for that is that it's really important to collaboratively talk with them about having a schedule that works. I keep telling parents this. And then when they go, I said, you know, ultimately you do it how you want. And then they always come back. Oh, I should have listened. It's that don't have screen time first thing in the morning. I don't think it's helpful for any kid, but especially not ADHD kids, because then that becomes their focus. And then you want to shift, get breakfast, get out the house, get dressed. And then you wonder why they can't shift and why they're now in a bad mood. You took away the dopamine. They don't need that much stimulation in the morning. You know, so I think that it's important to make sure that you regulate that, because screen time can be dysregulating. And because ADHD is a dysregulation disorder, screen time on top of dysregulation makes a nightmare. So there needs to be boundaries and limits around screen time, because if not, then they're going to only be interested in that, and they're not going to have interest in anything else. And they need to be able to find ways of entertaining themselves without always needing a screen. And there is a big difference that I see often between kids who have hobbies and kids who just do the screen. You need to do other things to stimulate your brain. Puzzles, Legos, drawing, bike riding, hiking, sewing. There are other things to do besides being on a screen.
What's the difference that you see?
They are, they have better, kids who have more hobbies, diverse hobbies, have better social skills. They have better eye contact. They have better reciprocal social engagement. Yeah. They're more socially intelligent, and they pick up on nuances. They know how to better read a room. They're just interesting to talk to. They have more to say because they have more variety of things to talk about. Kids who just do Roblox, Netflix, like, or YouTube, like, they don't really have anything to talk about, because all they're thinking about is the thing that is being fed to them, as opposed to something that they've created themselves. So I always see a big difference between kids who love to read and kids who do all these different random stuff, who use their brains, versus things that are always just fed to them and they're always being entertained.
Yeah.
They don't, it's very passive. It's very, very passive. You don't have to do anything actively to engage with things, because you're just allowing the screens and electronics to entertain you. So then they're easily bored and easily frustrated because of that.
But, you know, there are different, you know, there's a variety. I think all the things that you mentioned in terms of like all the social media apps and like Netflix, like in general, like all those things are very passive. But there's a lot of things that you can do on a screen that is very active, that's, you know, collaborative, that does require you to think and to problem solve. Do you see, you know, what if a child is actually doing, because, you know, like Minecraft is one of those things where, yeah, it's on a screen, but they are building and thinking, and maybe it is something that is easy. Maybe they are getting the blue light, but do you see maybe a difference, or do you see a different, you know, value or impact in children who are using maybe more active things on screens? Because even in video games, which very, you know, high dopamine, wants to keep your attention, but especially with online games, is the whole conversation of, well, you're collaborating with other people and you're working together as a team, and you are dealing with some frustration because trust, it's frustrating when you have an objective and a goal and you don't meet it, and, you know, you get shot or whatever happens, right? That is, and I think anyone who's ever watched people play kind of online games can identify pretty easily that, you know, people do have to tolerate frustration. And
yes,
maybe how they're tolerating it may not be something something you prefer, but I guess kind of my question, some of what I want to tease out is there a difference? Should we treat that screen time differently than watching Wildcraft, Peppa Pig, or?
I think it's better, but I still think, like, when you think about building on Minecraft, click, 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 that's very different than the fine motor development of building in Legos. Right? And again, it's still done for you. So even like ABC Mouse and those kinds of things, those educational math games and reading, it's still click, 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 wrong, right, as opposed to writing things out and figuring it out on your own. And so it's a different kind of mechanism. Yes, it's better, but I still think there's value in some of the old school ways of doing things
100%.
For a lot of these kids, because it helps with regulation. It helps with saying that I'm not always having to then be drawn to this, and it can still feel, there's still this passiveness about it. And again, it's just the thing that I notice in terms of regulation. I notice that kids who do too much of that getting entertained and feeling like they're relying on an electronic source, it's amazing that they're wiring themselves differently for frustration and for those kinds of things. So that, you know, then someone comes in and destroys their bill that they spent 5 hours on Minecraft and now they're melting down because the game froze or someone just destroyed it. And that regulation is different than if they were playing hardcore on the floor with Jenga or with, you know, Legos or something like that. And again, that face-to-face interaction with someone is very different than a screen on your headphones using all these code names and not really engaging with people, seeing their face, talking to people, you know?
Yeah, I do agree that there is, you know, it's not a substitute that even those more kind of active games where you are doing, you know, team building, you are maybe having to think critically, that it's definitely not a substitute for the real life things. And I think that is the big, you know, fear, at least the way that I see it, the big fear with screen time is that it takes away the opportunity to do all these real life things and, you know, work on, you know, the fine motor. And, you know, there's something different, there's something different about reading a book, like with the pages in your hand and reading it on a Kindle.
A device, right.
Yeah. So I think that is, you know, I definitely agree there. But I'm going to give a big but here. And sure, and we'll end it here. You can share what you think about it. give your response. I think that there are a lot of new skills that are being created as a result of technology.
Totally.
That the world is, and the pandemic, especially with virtual learning, was a great lesson in this. And while we won't necessarily go to virtual learning, some people may, but I think the world is continuously, maybe even more quickly than what we realize, moving towards using more technology and having to be proficient at it to be functional in society. And while I agree that too much screen time, too much of anything is a bad thing. And we need to be aware and mindful about how much we're using screen times and how, and not even just how much, the quality, how we feel when we are on screens, how we navigate the internet and the interwebs, how we have these conversations online, because it is a different feel. But I think that's going to be the world. Yeah, it's not the same. It's not the same as having a face-to-face conversation. But even right now, us together, we're having this conversation over the computer.
Electronic, right.
Yeah. And so, and I think there's some utility there in learning to navigate and being used to connecting to someone over Zoom or over a screen, because, you know, at first, before the pandemic, you couldn't really have Zoom meetings like you could now. Like, yeah, sure you could, but it wasn't something that was like acceptable or like, you're like, it just doesn't feel right. Like, I need to have this conversation face to face. And I think where a lot of the conversations pre-pandemic could have been Zoom meetings, you know, that we didn't really have to get up and do the face-to-face thing. Again, I'm not advocating for eliminating face-to-face contact.
Right.
But I think there's utility in learning and getting used to being able to communicate in all these different ways using
technology. I think if we do that, I think what I'm seeing happening, though, is that kids are being left to their own devices, literally and figuratively, and not being taught that. Right. So if you're going to say, yes, you could play on Among Us and do Roblox and Minecraft and you go online gaming, but you're not teaching them about online safety. You're not monitoring. They're on in their bed under their covers for hours and you have no idea who they're connecting with, what information they're sharing, what sites they're looking at. Then that's not responsible either. So I think it's about making sure there are some rules around that, some guidelines around that, so that we can also notice that. Because unfortunately, I've seen a lot of kids who have gotten into some pornography addiction and sites and inappropriate relationships and meetups because of that. And so again, we have to also be aware that this stuff is out there. Yeah. And once they're digital, anybody has access to your kid.
Yeah.
So they need to be also making sound decisions, and that you need to be aware of the games that they're playing too, because there are some games that are too creepy for little kids that they're playing as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And definitely there are like the videos that make it kind of seem like it's okay if you're not really paying attention, that like it is kid friendly, but it's really not.
It's not, right.
Yeah, that's, and I talk about like being your child's digital mentor and knowing what they're consuming and helping them navigate through this, because it's, the internet is a big world and has the potential to expose children to a lot more than what they may be ready for.
Exactly.
100%. Okay.
Good discussion, Chaz.
Yeah, I love it too. I might even break it up into two discussions. Screen time, I don't know. We'll see how it goes, but I'm stopping the broadcast. Thank you so much. Oh, before I even stop it, is there anything that you'd like to, you know, talk about, promote? Like, where can we find you? Plug in all your stuff.
So people can find me on Instagram. I'm most active there at Dr. Ann Louise Lockhart, and also on Facebook at A New Day Pediatric Psychology. I do have two courses if you want to know more about ADHD and kind of dive into it. I have one for parents of kids with ADHD on my website at anewdaysa.com. And then I also have one for adults. I had a huge request for a lot of adults who thought that they may have ADHD or a lot of executive functioning challenges. And so I have a course, a two-part course for people with those challenges or suspected ADHD that really walks them through all of it with a checklist and everything, so that you can explore it, and then specific strategies you can use to fine tune it in those areas as well too. And that you can find at anewdaysa.com as well too. So those are options available if you need to dive in deeper.
Oh, great. Stopping the broadcast. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yes.
And I may see you again in the future. Who knows?
Of course.
It'll definitely be through a screen.
Yeah.
What's my name? What's my name? What's my name?